welcome everybody.
You want this
we are honored
while you're talking
to have.
That's why we hate it. It's not very annoying.
Madame Phyllis Feeder, who has conducted and sung in front of all the crown heads of Europe, who will lead the musical program this evening. Madame Feeder.
We're going to hum Pomp and Circumstance, and we have to crescendo at times, and then when he's talking, we you know Pomp and Circumstance?
Yeah. Ready?
Alphabetical order by nation, I welcome on your behalf Queen Margaretha II of Denmark. The Queen, I suppose it is a particular honor that the Danish Queen is with us this evening. Denmark is the world's oldest continuous monarchy. Every one of those heads of state being either Frederick or Christian until Margaretha came along. Queen Margaretha II, Her Royal Highness. Tarja Halonen of Finland. President Halonen, I will point out, as I know is important to this audience to know, that Finland is a republic, not a constitutional monarchy, and that you are an elected head of state. Now in your 10th year, the first woman to be the president of Finland, the first Helsinkiite, the first person from the wrong side of the tracks,
fallen woman.
Will you forgive my irreverence, President Halonen, if I say you're a tough old bird? President Olafur Grimsson has come from Reykjavik, the president of the Republic of Iceland. Again, President Grimsson, forgive my irreverence, but you have a rather ashen look. I know that these have not been easy months for you. The financial collapse of your nation is not something that you are taking lightly, I know. And that we know that night after night, week after week, month after month now, following the decision of the Icelandic Parliament that the financial losses sustained by investors in Great Britain, principally in Great Britain and Netherlands, must be repaid out of the thin billfolds of the citizens of the small nations, Those groups gathering on your lawn, President Grimson, have not made life particularly easy for you. But you have had a long and distinguished administration. Welcome from Reykjavik. Fourth of our honored guests tonight, His Royal Highness Harald the Fifth of Norway. Ken Harald, you are only the third monarch of your very young nation. I think it important that I point out to this audience that Norway did not become an independent nation until 1905. And you follow in the very large footsteps of your grandfather, Håkon, and your father, Olaf. Welcome to Harald. Is greatly valued in the Five Nations. You have brought great distinction in leading the Nordic countries' principal nation. There is some risk, isn't there, King, in saying that, but in terms of population and so many resources. You have inspired the international community, the peace community, with your strong support for seeking peaceful negotiations of international crises. Welcome. Thank you all. Now, we're going to be somewhat short, so I am wondering if, for example, if you are here with someone that you have known previously, if two of you could share what will be your textbook for these five sessions. So I'll ask for a couple of people if they will get this distributed.
The problem is the printer is down, so we can't make more.
Well, I look forward to this opportunity to talk with you. I'll just make a couple, three personal remarks about why I have become so interested in the Nordic countries. I was a Yingling assistant professor at Luther College in Flora, Iowa in the 1960s when my very favorite student, Paul Olson, was a member of that student body. When those were the glorious days when there was money going. And the National Science Foundation established grants for faculty members who would use time away to restructure their courses. And I had come as a result of being a part of the Luther College milieu to realize that there was a great deal happening in what we then called the Scandinavian countries, and had the opportunity with my family to spend a little over a year at the Institute for Social Research in Oslo, but to make many trips to the other countries. When the National Science Foundation made these grants, we kind of took a pledge, which I think I'd taken seriously. I hate to sound like Goody Two Shoes, but and that was that we would thoroughly re-examine what it was we were teaching and why it was we were teaching what we were teaching. And so I've tried through all these subsequent years to give students a sense of the, I think, remarkable experiments, not all successful, but so many of them so bold in public policy, from cradle to grave. And I'm going to use a few case studies in the days that we are together to try to illustrate that. Now, in the blurb out on the kiosk and that sort of thing, I dropped the shoe that when I said about this course, oops, I almost said the Scandinavian countries. Let me explain. For decades, Finland, and to a lesser degree, the Icelanders said, we aren't Scandinavians.
Thank you.
Why are you lumping us together with Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, which legitimately form a peninsula and a peninsula and some islands reaching up to the major peninsula, and who share a basic language which, though rather different, is still possible for Norwegians, Swedes, and Danes more or less understand one another, speaking the same language. But the Finns said, look, our, our genotype is not Scandinavian. We aren't always those tall, blonde people, whom, by the way, people here aren't either. We certainly do not speak a Scandinavian language. Our root family is called Finno-Ugric, and we speak a language which, to a faint degree, Estonians will understand, but no one else in this world. And we have a different destiny, and we have a different vision. Our political and our international interests are much more in the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, many ways. But the what I'm going to call the Scandinavians, it's quite appropriate when I'm speaking of these three countries that I use Scandinavia, just didn't much listen. Well, the times are a-changing over there. Finland has at least two of the major privately owned, publicly traded corporations on the European stock exchanges, Nokia, of course, which we well know, and United Paper, which owns now many of the principal paper mills in the United States and elsewhere. Meanwhile, the Icelanders, God love them, there are only about 300,000 of them, we're saying, too, we really rebel at being called Scandinavian because we speak the mother tongue of the Scandinavian languages. We speak Old Norse. It's a bit like saying we speak the English of Chaucer. And we want to maintain that linguistic distinctiveness. So, always seeking to be politically correct, the word not so known in the United States yet, but more and more in Europe, is the Nordic countries, or Norden, N-O-R-D-E-N, which means the North. It is a term around which the five nations can rally. And now, the textbook. How did we do on it? Does about at least every other person have one? The handout. And by tomorrow, John, who is assisting us from the audiovisual, believes that he'll be able to have more copies made of it. Let's go. If you'll read page one, I tried to give you an idea about some of the policy case studies that I'm going to be using, focusing, I hope, exemplifying what's going on in each of the five countries, issues to do with gender, with childhood, with medical care, with peacekeeping, and so forth. But page two is all you ever wanted to know, but were afraid to ask. I hope. In which I have labored a little to try to compress some things here, and on your own, I wish that you would give some particular attention to this squib in which I do if I was on a fool's errand, to try to compress the history of the Nordic countries into one paragraph. But I think much of what I say will make sense if you'll take some time on your own to read that. I would just say that I start out this course saying that one of my commitments that I want to convey is that these five nations, though they have many bonds, the five flags each with the early medieval Christian cross in five colors speak to those bonds, but they are not peas in a pod. And let me use as just one example before I move into the chart. Let's take World War II and consider how very different the destinies of the five nations were. I'll always try to go alphabetically. Denmark was invaded overnight in April of 1940 by the Germans. The tanks and the military rolled in over an unprotected border. Denmark is absolutely flat. There was no hiding. There was very little opportunity for guerrilla warfare in Denmark. And in very short order, the Danes capitulated, surrendered to the Germans. I have such a problem as to what term should be used. German tars a lot of people who were certainly not involved. Nazi presents its complications. I was recently in the museum of the portraying the history of the resistance to the occupation in Oslo, and I noticed on the panels in English next to each display that the author of the panels used a word that isn't in the Merriam-Webster, at least yet, the Hitlerists. And maybe that's, I think I'll use that term if I can remember. At any rate, Denmark surrendered. It, not without a most valiant chapter in its history. I think you may know this story. The Hitlerist high command was no sooner ensconced in one of the principal governmental buildings in Copenhagen, pronounced Turpenhorn by the Danes, and never Copenhagen. Danny Kaye did that to it, but the regime was no sooner ensconced than the order came out that all Jews must wear the Star of David armband. And on that Sunday morning, following that Saturday announcement, King Christian Frederick XI got on his horse, and he rode the horse down the utterly silent street, the great boulevard of Copenhagen called the Strøget, and he was wearing Star of David. And the stiffening of the spines of the Danes was not immediate. Whenever we get to wondering how other countries can afford royalty the costs of monarchy from many perspectives, keep in mind its enormous potential for leadership at times like that. I need to go quickly, of course, through a lot here. So I move on alphabetically to Finland, which in a way it would seem hardly knew of our World War II or Denmark's World War II, because it was engaged in its own series of brutal wars with its neighbor all the way down its... I am so proud of this. It represents a climb to the highest point I have ever reached in audiovisual production. Look at what Finland has. Its entire eastern border with then the Soviet Union. Finland in 1940, now we can, I can't get into all the nuances of this, but you may know from your memories, unbelievably, little Finland with then not quite 5 million people attacked the Soviet Union in a series of wars called the Winter Wars. An enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Germans offered aid to Finland, Germany and Russia then being in opposition to one another at that earlier stage of World War II. Many Finns of that period, educated Finns, especially engineers and scientists, had been educated in Germany. Finland's president, though a Finn, Count von Mannerheim, was a German, and it seemed a sensible pact for the Finns to accept German aid. Though Finland, all in its cagey way, all through that, kept its distance from Germany. Its Jews were not deported, much less exterminated, so forth and on. Something called the Continuation Wars against Russia broke out during this period, where the Finns hopelessly outmanned. But with tremendous morale and tremendous genius in their military hierarchy, persisted in those wars, though ultimately lost them. And if you look at this boundary, I've used different maps for different purposes. Forgive me, I have these maps in hard copy for you. Thanks, Jean. It's in my... I have a copy for each of you.
It's a little bit clearer now, if that helps.
Okay. Will you distribute these? I'll keep one. Thank you. What you'll see then in a minute or two in front of you is if you notice the straight line slice of the boundary of Finland and Russia down here in the most important agricultural and industrial area, you realize that is not a natural boundary. Nor is a boundary right about here. The Soviets demanded about 10% of the Finnish land, as well as enormous reparations when the dust settled. In 1944, with the leadership of President Franklin Roosevelt, as well as Winston Churchill, prevailed upon the Finns to renounce their pact with Germany, and promised the support of the Allies, and they received the support of the Allies. But what I'm trying to say is that it was a particularly tough war. I remember my first time in Finland. On a winter Saturday night, I was in 1965, I was in the Central Railroad Station in Helsinki, which of course is warm and well-maintained, and it was full of men whom I would judge to have been in their 60s and 70s. It was the high percentage of them that were missing at least one limb. That was the Winter Wars. So Finland's route was different. Then alphabetically take Iceland, which on the eve of World War II had reached almost the boiling point in its desire for independence. Iceland was a territory or a protectorate of Denmark until then. And in 1944, in the midst of all the tumult, Iceland received independence. Denmark ceded it over, but with a very interesting stipulation, which came from the Allies, not least the United States and Great Britain, that Iceland would, and I forget now if it is what's to be for one century or what, provide an airfield on the fog-free western coast of Iceland. It's called Keflavik, and if you have flown the Iceland airline, you have landed at Keflavik, because Iceland and that airfield were so immensely crucial to the Allied war effort. Our bombers could land for refueling, probably first at Gander in Newfoundland and then flying on to Reykjavik and then to Prestwick in Scotland before flying over Germany, for example. So Iceland was certainly with the Allies, but one could certainly, what might say, was preoccupied with its own independence. Take Norway. The Hitlerists had no sooner invaded Denmark when their ships, containing some very prominent admirals, that sort of thing, sailed northward toward Oslo. Much fascinating reading here. Some I think pretty informed speculation that the Norwegian government had gotten plenty of warnings that the Germans had their eye on Norway, and they invaded on April 9, 1940, and the Norwegian experience in World War II was a little bit different. Norway had what emerged was an indigenous puppet government, which was Hitlerist, led by a Norwegian white supremacist named Vidkun Quisling. It's been my good intention to use all these projectors and screens, not going to go crazy, to write down names like this, but I'll try to do that and flash a transparency to you tomorrow. Vidkun Quisling and his followers, who came to be called the Quislings, were put in power in Norway. Now, much is fascinating about the occupation of Norway in World War II. I think this must be said. Hitler and the German high command knew very well how crucial Norway was. Right up in here is the small but important port of Narvik, N-A-R-V-I-K. Right here is Kiruna, in Sweden. I think it shows on your maps. Kiruna is the source of rich iron ore mining, but the iron ore can only be shipped out through Narvik. And so if Narvik, that is to say, Norway, could be occupied, the iron ore could not be shipped to Britain to be made into steel, to be made into munitions. I have read stuff, too, that indicates that Churchill had his eye on Norway. Perhaps if the Germans hadn't gotten there first, the Brits would have. It was that crucial, not for its own resources. Those goodness knows Norway had, it was known, the heavy water down here that was crucial to the making of the atomic bomb. But Norway's resistance was very, very strong. Of course, it's an almost totally mountainous nation, and the Norwegians knew where to hide, and it proved to be an extremely expensive undertaking for the Germans to occupy Norway. Meanwhile, so that I can get on with the show, Sweden followed the same policy that it had in World War I, and I think throughout its history, at least since the Napoleonic Wars, the official and the guiding foreign policy of Sweden, like Switzerland, is neutrality. And we can, and believe me, these issues are debated very much in late at night in the living rooms and over a beer in Denmark and Norway too. Did the Swedes do the right thing in not resisting? Compliant in a lot of ways. Sweden was able to give sanctuary to a very great many people. The great Swedish diplomat, Raoul Wallenberg, transported many Jews from Denmark on boats across the narrow strait there into Sweden. Finnish children who were starving, really, from villages in Finland came into Sweden in large numbers, at least for their summers, to be able to live with Swedish families. Things that might not have been possible, likely would not have been possible in an occupied nation. Well, with that, let's move to the chart. And much of it is self-explanatory. Right along the top, I have some dates to keep in mind again that Denmark and Sweden are very old nations, that Finland got its independence from Russia. It was a Grand Duchy of Russia in 1914, and Iceland, as I have said, from Denmark in 1944, and Norway in 1905. I'm going to take just a little bit more time on the Norwegian case. Norway was under Denmark until 1814, and not without its resentments toward Denmark. When they thought they were breaking loose. And on that day of May 17th, 1814, some of the greatest figures in early Norway, literary lions like Bjørnson and Wergeland, assembled and created a constitution for their new nation. They had excellent models. The American and the French constitutions had, of course, both emerged just before 1814. And so here was Norway feeling its oats, ready to go, and a constitution signed, which is celebrated in many a parade, even in the U.S. in places like Brooklyn and Ballard, I believe. Sittendamai, the 17th of May, it became almost immediately apparent to the Norwegians that they weren't going to make it as an independent nation. They just simply did not have the financial wherewithal. I mean, you've got to establish a mint, you've got to establish a national bank, you've got to establish embassies in the major capitals, and on and on and on. And so the Swedes stepped forward in 1814 and said, Norway, we are brothers. We offer to you to be our partner, our equal partner in what was called the joint monarchy of Sweden and Norway. Note that it's not alphabetical order. And Norway really had no choice. And it wasn't the world's worst arrangement. But in 1905, with a little bit of static and turbulence, but a rather peaceful separation, dissolution took place. And in 1905, Norway was became truly independent. And the Norwegians looked around and said, well, all we really have as role models is Denmark and Sweden and, to an extent, Great Britain. But I guess we should have a monarch, an HRH. And so there was a plebiscite all over Norway. First people got to write letters and they could nominate people, and people were digging up who the nephews of old King Boris in Bulgaria or Zug in Albania, that sort of thing were, because you know that was the drill, that it'd be a royal from somewhere. And the Norwegians, in a popular vote, elected the king to get the whole thing started. And they chose a young crown prince in Denmark. And he was renamed with a great old Norwegian name, Håkon. And he came with his wife, a daughter of Victoria and Albert, to Norway to be the first king. And it didn't go very well the first years for the king. It became clearly apparent that he wasn't about to learn Norwegian. Speak the language. He spoke Danish. And Copenhagen was thought to be, you know, the Norwegians were more like peasants and that kind of thing. But again, to repeat the Danish saga in this regard, in 1940, when Norway was occupied, the immense symbolic power and moral example of the king and queen, who established a government in exile in England, and were often many of the Norwegian officials were in Canada. The king led in a way that the prime minister could not, and more of that later. So, I got to get to get off here. The populations will be evident to you. Sweden is about double the population of the other big three, Finland and Denmark, and are just above 5 million, and look a lot like Minnesota demographically in that respect. And Iceland, of course, is so small a nation that you may wonder why we are going to spend time on it, and it won't be a lot. The square miles, I've indicated states that are similar. That will be the capital cities are evident. But just a little bit, you know, I mean, if you're going to get invited to cocktail parties at the royal palaces and at the president's homes in Helsinki and Reykjavik, I mean, I want you to be informed. he moves here. Let me just say a little bit about languages. Nordic countries present more linguistic controversies than you can shake a stick at. In Denmark, the language, it's fairly straightforward. The language is Danish, called Dansk. In Finland, this inscrutable Finno-Ugric language called Suomi is one language, but about 12% of the population of Finland, among them some of the wealthier families, and more concentrated on the western coast of Finland, have always historically spoken Swedish. And so Finland has two languages. Its school children, beginning in about second grade, just before they begin their study of English in about third grade, must begin learning Swedish. And every Finnish city has two names. Helsinki is a Finnish name. Helsingfors is the Swedish word for it. And I can tell you that the 88% of Finns who don't like this idea of having to learn Swedish, their buns can get in an uproar on that subject. But the Finnish government, I believe, recognizes that if Finland is to take its place as a crucial player, not only in Europe generally, but in the Nordic bloc, its people must be able to communicate in a Scandinavian language. And so it has come about. In Iceland, there is extreme pride in the language, which I will call Old Norse. The Icelanders can pick up Morgunblaðið, the leading daily in Reykjavik, and read it as though it were the old sagas, or I should have said it the other way, the old Viking sagas read like today's newspaper, Finland. There is a linguistic academy in Reykjavik which finds an old Norse word every time there is a need for a new word, or any time a loan word, a foreign term, might slip into the language, okay, or Coca-Cola, or whatever. And so it's incredible. When the word computer came along, the Linguistic Academy went to work, and they found the Old Norse term for numbers and the Old Norse term for prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, number prophets, and that's the term used for computer, and on and on and on. At the same time, the Icelanders, like the Finns, recognize that they have to be able to communicate in a Scandinavian language, and so their children, at about second or third grade, begin the study of Danish. In Norway, the language issues are I think, the most complicated. I should have said in Finland, but in Finland, Norway, and Sweden, there is a language of the indigenous people called Sami. We used to say Laps, not politically correct at all. The Sami, S-A-M-I people. Now moving from that, the valleys of Norway, separated by impenetrable mountain ridges, before there were railroads or roads, the dialects of the valleys, because people were not able to travel across Norway, you couldn't get from Bergen to Oslo except by sea, and that sort of thing, developed such strong dialect patterns that the joke is that when someone from the Sognefjord area of the west coast goes to Trondheim, they speak in English to one another. But in addition, in the late, in the early 20th century, to go back to the to the new king and his use of Danish, there was an immense fervor in the rural areas, a kind of a prairie populism in the mountains, which said, why in the hell are we speaking Danish or a Danish impregnated language? And so a little school teacher guy in a country school out in some valley in Norway used his summers to travel the valleys and to copy down word patterns and idioms and dialects, and he invented a new language, a sheer invention, and published a dictionary. Unbelievable. And the language is called Nynorsk, New Norwegian. And though the numbers who speak it have declined now to about 14% of the population, it is very much favored by many people in the arts, in the humanities. It's thought to be a more poetic language, perhaps not very adequate as a scientific language. And feelings run hard. So every day on the Norwegian television, if the 6 o'clock news is in national Norwegian, the 10 o'clock news must be in new Norwegian. And if new commemorative stamps are printed for every 10 sheets that are where Norway is spelled N-O-R-G-E, Norge, the national Norwegian name for it, the 11th sheet is spelled N-O-R-E-G. And every poster at the post office is in both languages. And this is a bit expensive. And aside, the school authorities at one point said, enough of this, our children are so confused. And they set about to invent a language called Samnorsk, cooperative Norwegian, blending the two, and it's hated so by both sides that it's irrelevant. But in Sweden, finally, the Swedes speak Swedish. To continue. You have met the heads of state. It's important you meet the heads of government. If you go in the textbook to page 6, I've flipped them. How many of you saw the film with Helen Mirren, The Queen?
Yes.
Good. Well, remember, it's that wonderful scene. It deals with the refusal, the difficult position that the Queen was put in when Princess Di died. The immense sentiment in the British populace to fly the flag over Buckingham Palace at half-mast, and the Queen refused to do that. I mean, there had been a divorce, she was no longer the princess, and so forth. And the then very new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, paid a call on the Queen. His calls on the Queen were not graciously received, I must say, although this is, it's a movie, and I don't know how truthful or accurate it is, but the Queen said something interesting. She said, you must understand, Mr. Prime Minister, that I am the voice of the state, of the nation, of the heritage. I am Britain. And if you recall, and I'm paraphrasing wildly, Tony Blair said, you must understand, Your Highness, that I am the elected Prime Minister. I am the voice of the government. And so we have in the parliamentary system and with free monarchies, we have both head of state and prime minister. They are quite apart from the fact that everybody is young to me, but quite young, aren't they? Sweden's It's Frederick Reinfeldt. Would you write that again? Down at the bottom, R-E-I-N-F-E-L-D-T, was born in 1965. I've done a little digging on the origins of the prime ministers who are members of the parliament. They were elected from their counties to serve in the parliament, and then if their party or coalition got the majority of the parliament and they were selected to serve as the prime minister. Four of the five have, a remarkable similarity in interest. They were all big-time student government leaders in their university days. I have spent in my last year or so, on the average of 2 months each, at seven universities in Finland, Sweden, and Norway. And I can tell you that the rectors of those universities, when a call comes from the president of the student union that he wishes to speak with the rector, she goes hat in hand to the student union building to do so. So they built a political base early on. At least one is also of an extremely prominent political family. Norway's Jens Stoltenberg. His mother was the deputy secretary, the minister of foreign affairs. Stoltenberg, the one exception to this is the almost brand new prime minister in Iceland, Johanna Sigurðardóttir. Iceland has a patronymic naming system. We know that she is the daughter of Sigurdarson, and that if she has a brother, his surname is Sigurdarson. Her case, just a sign of the times again. She is the first head of state in the world, to my knowledge, who is out as a lesbian. She was 10 years ago a very ordinary flight attendant for the Iceland Air, and she became the head of the union for the flight attendants, and from that catapulted into the parliament, and is now the prime minister, who is having to pull the chestnuts out of the fire which surround the collapse of the three banks in Iceland. Is that now a year ago, or give or take? So there they are. As I'm going to go on to say and make sense of it, I hope, two, Stoltenberg of Norway and Sigurðardóttir, are from the Labour Party, and the other three are from what is called in Europe, or in especially in the Nordic countries, the bourgeois coalition. Bourgeois is used here as a pejorative. This is a bourgeois, but it means it represents the interests of people who have property. So the countries are, the five nations are quite divided in that respect. President Hallinen, however, over in Finland, is an old wobbly, really, a Green Labour leader type. But these are the prime ministers. I'm going to go back on that for maybe you can share with someone here. And with that, let's go down the chart. And let me get into some numbers. I'm on the third to the last line. You're gonna have to pull the plug on your 7:15, isn't it?
It is, yeah. he's on vacation.
It's 7:15, and I don't know where my children are. So, feel free, and gather again. Is it 4 o'clock tomorrow? When I'll finish up this chart, and then I'd like to do some geography 101 and some poli-sci 101 with you, and use the last 3 days in talking about the immigrant issues, the issues that are surrounding children and medical care and so forth, and the issues around schooling and religion as case studies. So we'll take it from there, and thanks for coming.